Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is conductor, musician, author, and public speaker Benjamin Zander. Zander is the conductor of the Boston Philharmonic and Philharmonic Youth Orchestra and taught at the New England Conservatory for 45 years. With London's Philharmonia Orchestra, he's recording the complete cycle of Mahler symphonies, recordings that have been received with great critical acclaim both for the performance along with Zander's now famous full-length disc explaining the music for the lay listener. His recordings of Mahler's Ninth and Bruckner's Fifth Symphony were nominated for Grammys for Best Orchestral Performance. His latest recording, Mahler's Second Symphony, was nominated for a Grammy in 2014 and will be the work he conducts as guest conductor with the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday evening at 7:30 with the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus and Soloist. In addition to his musical work, he's co-authored the best-selling book, The Art of Possibility, with his wife and partner, Rosamund Zander, and is a sought-after speaker for his views on collaboration, executive skills, inclusion, and human potential. He'll be speaking to several groups while he's here, and of course, conducting Mahler Symphony No. 2, The Resurrection, Saturday evening at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. You can learn more at tulsasymphony.org. Benjamin Zander is my guest today. Benjamin Zander, welcome back to Tulsa, and welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. I was here 10 years ago.
Has it really been that long?
10 years. I conducted what I was told was the first performance ever of the Fifth Symphony of Gustav Mahler, and now I'm back to conduct the Second Symphony, The Resurrection, probably the most loved, popular, and overwhelming experience you can have in a concert hall.
Now, you've conducted this particular piece many, many times. You've just recorded it, so you spent an awful lot of time probably in preparation for that recording several years ago. Does it ever get less than just a tremendous sort of, it's an experience, it's a journey that you take with this particular symphony?
It's absolutely amazing that you would point that out, because I was thinking that exact thing last night. It was my 77th birthday, and I arrived from Boston and walked into that room, into the hall, and there was the orchestra collected, this huge orchestra. And I thought, there's nothing in the world I would imagine more exciting, more rewarding, more thrilling than starting the Second Symphony of Gustav Mahler. The idea that I would ever be tired of it, or that I wouldn't be not only not tired of it, but that I would ever not be enlivened and thrilled and excited and overwhelmed again by this piece. Well, you know, this is a piece, it's different from other pieces. The Second Symphony of Mahler is the thing that made Simon Rattle a musician. Gilbert Kaplan, as a 21-year-old, went to hear a performance of Mahler's Second, and at the end of it, he said the hairs on the back of his head rose up. He said, never had this experience before. And he said, I've got to spend the rest of my life with this piece. And he basically gave his life to this piece, and he started performing it all over the world. He'd learned to conduct so that he could conduct the piece, and he bought the score, and he bought the house in which it was, the heart in which Mahler's composed the work. And I mean, it totally dominated his life for the rest of his life.
And it has that effect. So what is it about this piece that caused that sort of obsession?
Yes, if you could explain it, of course, then we could reproduce it. it's magic. It's partly the range of emotion, the size of the orchestra, the fact that he brings in everything. He brings in a gigantic orchestra, a choir, 115 players, soloists, organ, offstage bands, soloists, I mean, it's the whole world. And he, in five movements and an hour and a half, he traverses all of human experience, from the deepest despair to the greatest joy, from tragedy and darkness and struggle, transfigured into triumph at the end, and a triumph expressed in such a way, like the end of the Beethoven Ninth. That's the only other piece that I can think of that could compare. And I think it's even more overwhelming than the Beethoven Ninth. Those are the two pieces that stand at the pinnacle of Western culture. And here we are in Tulsa. We're going to have it here in Tulsa on Saturday night. I mean, this is something, this is like visiting the pyramids. Imagine you went to Egypt and said, oh, well, never mind about the pyramids. We'll pass that by, you know, or go to Rome and don't, you know, it's Sistine Chapel. I mean, this is the pinnacle of human experience is in this piece. And I wouldn't argue that it's the greatest piece of music, although it may be, but it's a pinnacle. It's like King Lear. It's like the greatest human achievements, and it's unimaginable to think that a human being could actually create such a thing out of nothing. I mean, it's just amazing. And last night at the rehearsal, you were there playing, and there's a sense of excitement, of passion, of intensity, of engagement, of thrill that is very rare in our lives. It's a very rare experience to have that kind of excitement. So what would I want to do more exciting than that on my birthday? And if people haven't heard it, and most people, of course, in the community here have not heard it, because I believe it's only been done maybe once, something like that, before. And so this is an occasion of very, very great significance.
And of course, Mahler is one of the great things about this piece is you hear a lot of the history of classical music in this piece. Yeah. You hear Beethoven, you hear Bruckner, you hear a Brahmsian melody. Yeah. You hear things that you're really going to hear in the 20th century. You hear what Prokofiev is going to use in Shostakovich in some of his
Absolutely.
Works.
Absolutely. Those composers you picked out are two of the many who were profoundly influenced by Mahler. In fact, the whole world was influenced by Mahler, not only the musicians, but the writers, the philosophers, the thinkers, the filmmakers, the dramatists. Mahler was a colossus. He stood at the crossroads of the 20th century with Freud and with Marx and with the great figures, all of them incidentally Jewish figures, interestingly enough.
Many of them in Vienna, too.
And all of them gathered in Vienna. I'm extraordinary. And they changed the world in every field and in every part. And the world was never the same. And Mahler was a kind of a godlike figure in Vienna. After the emperor, he was the best-known person in the country, and people would watch him walking through the streets and say, "There's Mahler." You know, he was a composer. And nowadays that doesn't happen.
He was Beyonce.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, he was the
celebrity.
He
of
was the
day.
Giant. He was the giant, and everybody was excited about knowing him. People telling stories about it. And as I'm rehearsing the orchestra, I'm sharing some of those experiences and some of those stories to remind people. Some of the younger musicians don't know a lot of this stuff because it's now long ago. But my father was 13 when somebody was at lunch at his house, and he said, "Today Gustav Mahler died, and he is as great as Bach and Beethoven and Brahms and Schubert." And my father thought, what a grotesque idea, as a modern composer could be compared. But actually it's proved to be the case, like Beethoven.
And one of the things you've stressed in preparing the orchestra is, one, this Symphony No. 2 is a Viennese work.
Right.
And you have everything from the ghost of Beethoven and Brahms and everyone else, along with Johann Strauss.
Yes.
And the
last
popular
night,
music.
We were working, you were there, we had this lovely experience of the second movement of the Mahler. As you said, it comes from that tradition of the waltz. It's actually a Ländler, which means from the country. So there were town waltzes and country waltzes, and this is more a country waltz. And I was really teaching the orchestra, because it's a style which is not taught at the conservatories. Very free, very elastic, with rubato, what we call rubato, which is like the stretching of time. And I feel rubato is as important to Mahler's music as tomatoes are to a spaghetti bolognese. You know, in other words, without it isn't there, right? And so I had to actually teach that, and that's part of my job, is to pass that on. And they did it very, very beautifully. It would be fun to hear. Why do we hear a little bit of the first opening of the second movement of the Mahler second, which is the most intimate, the most quiet and gentle and loving and tender moment in the symphony. And it shows that this is the Philharmonia Orchestra, which I'm recording all the symphonies with the Philharmonia. And talking of Beyonce, this recording was actually nominated for a Grammy, but it was beaten out by Beyonce. So.
For the best sound, yes.
Right. But this is the true Mahlerian spirit with all that freedom, very rare quality of sound. Just play a few.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the beginning of the second movement with Benjamin Zander conducting the Philharmonia Orchestra from his most recent recording here on Studio Tulsa. That's music by my guest today, Benjamin Zander, leading the Philharmonia Orchestra in his most recent recording in his cycle of Mahler symphonies, the Symphony No. 2, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra with Benjamin Zander this Saturday night, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, along with it being a Viennese work, it is also, you say, it's a Jewish work, and there's a lot of Jewish influences, and there are not in the score, but there are inflections that have to be in this particular piece.
Well, like all traditions, jazz, South American music, you know, whatever the music is, it's passed on from generation to generation, and it has characteristic qualities, sounds, harmonies, textures, and so on. And the Mahler was a Jew. He also became a Christian, although most people think that that was a strategic move in order to, because he could not, as a Jew, be the conductor of the great opera in Vienna. That was an impossibility. And when he composed the Resurrection Symphony, it was not a Christian resurrection. It was the renewal of human beings. I mean, it was it's a universal message. It's not.
Now, did he put the subtitle on this
movie? No, yes.
Yeah. Was that also sort of a strategic move?
No, I don't think
so. You don't think so?
No. It is, the piece is actually about the Day of Judgment. I mean, the final movement describes the Day of Judgment. And it's an extraordinary, thrilling thing, because if people want to know what the Day of Judgment is going to be like, they should come to the hall on Saturday night and they'll hear exactly.
You're going to hear the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The opening of the graves and the marching of all the dead souls and so on. And it's all there. But it's not a Christian resurrection. It's a universal renewal of human beings through the story of the Day of Judgment. It's an incredibly powerful idea. And, I mean, the idea that you have to die in order to live, that's the essential idea. It's a very, very moving end. I mean, tears down the face kind of thing. People are over at the first performance, complete strangers. Men would hug each other in the aisle of the thing. People were sobbing and crying. I mean, it's just an overwhelming experience. And so there are a few things in life that you can do that will guarantee just a complete transformation of your whole way of thinking. That's the Mahler Second Symphony.
I mean, were we talking about the Jewish themes?
Right. Well, Mahler was a Jew, and he grew up in that community, and he knew all the songs, and he played the harmonium, and in the first symphony, there's a very specific quotations, not actual quotations, but you can tell it's pure klezmer music. Mm-hmm. There's nothing of that obviousness in the second symphony, but there are many inflections. For instance, when the bass is playing boom, 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 that's the same as Fiddler on the Roof. I mean, you know, it comes the same quality. And so I'm encouraging the orchestra to broaden their range of expression. So don't just play symphonic, but play all, you know, when there's some Jewish element there, let's bring it out. And
do you think Mahler Symphony instinctively knew that, being in Vienna, that inflection should be there?
You mean if there's an orchestra in Vienna playing?
Well, I'm just saying, when Mahler wrote that, was it sort of implicit that you would do it that way?
Yes, absolutely. That would have been in the natural style of their playing. Also, the slides, you know, the little slides between notes and certain all sorts of little inflections. And I do that partly with my body language, so I don't have to talk about it. One of the reasons I talk about these things in the rehearsals is because so many of the members of the orchestra are also teachers. And I talked to 10 or 11 different players yesterday. All of them say, oh, yes, I teach here, I conduct a youth orchestra here. They're all doing other things. They're not full-time members of the orchestra playing all day and not doing anything else. So if I have some experience or some information or some insights which could be valuable for them as teachers, then this week is not just preparing a concert and then it stops, but the influence goes on then into their life. And for instance, one of the things that I do, very unusual, is I always feel that it's unfair that the conductor gets to talk and the players have to be silent. They're not allowed to speak. Nobody speaks, right? They're not allowed to. I mean, you might ask a question, but it's very unusual. So the conductor does all the talking, which means that he totally dominates the scene. Does that mean that the conductor is better than all the players put together? No, not at all. It's nonsense. So, like in any leadership situation, it would be really wise for the leader who happens to have the microphone to hear what the other people in the orchestra are thinking. And so I put a white sheet of paper, half a sheet of paper, on their stand and say, if you have any observations, any concerns, any criticisms, any suggestions, any comments, whatever, please put them down and sign your name so that we can have a conversation. Well, I got 20 of them yesterday, and some of them were very, very thoughtful. A few were very practical, you know, what's going on here, a question, normal question. But a few of them were observations, and as people get more used to it, I hope they'll be more engaged. And then I was just talking to one of the violin players. He said, I'm going to do that with my junior high school orchestra. He said, because it never occurred to me that I should get feedback. Well, I do that with my youth orchestra, and the kids are incredibly expressive, and they develop their own capacity to communicate and to think and to be responsible for the whole. That's what we want. We want people in an orchestra to feel responsible for the whole venture.
That's pretty rare in the classical music world. I think there was an article you were quoted in which sort of looked at the difference in job satisfaction between the average major symphony orchestra musician and the average chamber music musician. The chamber music musician, because they're equals, they're collaborating, they have some of the highest job satisfaction, and some of the lowest is
orchestra
symphony orchestras.
Came in this study, orchestra players came below prison guards because they don't have a voice. And if there's something that's not working for an orchestra musician, they have no say in the matter. Whereas through the white sheet, if they have, I mean, there are great musicians who play in orchestras.
What have you learned from some of those white sheets over the years?
Everything. I learned everything from them because they're playing. Right? They're actually playing. I don't make a sound. Right? So who would know whether the phrasing is comfortable or whether the space given for a phrase is enough or whether... And, of course, it's not only that. It's also that so many of these musicians love the music so deeply and have such deep feelings about it and experience with it. And why wouldn't the leader draw on all that knowledge and insight? And it doesn't mean I have to follow everything. People will suggest something, and I say thank you for sharing and go on and do exactly what I was doing because I'm not enrolled in what they're saying. But at least I give them a voice. So that is part of what I'm bringing. It's a style of leadership, if you like. It's a way of leadership that is actually turning out to be extremely valuable for corporate leaders. And I do a lot of speaking to corporate leaders precisely about these issues of how do you use power effectively. Power for me is like manure. It's better when you spread it around.
Right. Well, it sounds like you get very practical suggestions of, say, a wind player says, you know, this phrase is really long. I need a moment here to
I get everything. I get some of that.
But do you get responses that make you really think about the arc of the piece and how your own conception of the piece?
I mean, I would say it's not common, but I have a few people in my orchestra in Boston who I can pretty much rely on to be thinking about the big picture in a very valuable way. This is wonderful. I got a letter the other day, it was a while ago, from one of my second violinists, very thoughtful fellow. He said, what you're doing in this passage, I absolutely hate it. So I looked, and he was right. Do you know the Tchaikovsky film? Da 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 da
da da da da da da da
da da da da da da da da da And he hated it because if you do something like that four times, it's manipulative. If you do it once, it's thrilling. And he said that. And so I don't do that anymore.
Really?
Out the window. You know. So it's nice to know. And here I am telling you about it. Isn't that nice? So my role, I have a role as a conductor. Leaders have roles. And it doesn't make them better than other people. It's just they have a certain role. Nobody else, you have to have a conductor. You've got 120 musicians. You can't not have a conductor. But that's it. It's a role. Then the second violins have imagined the piece without the second violins or the second trumpet. So everybody has a role. And we're all part of the process. And we're all equally valuable. And so I break down that hierarchy. And I think musicians feel that, and they feel more joy, more engagement, more sense of participation, responsibility, and more at ease, because the other trouble is dis-ease comes from disease. I mean, disease comes from disease. So anything we can do as teachers or leaders or parents or people in response to minimize the dis-ease of the people that we're responsible for, that is a valuable thing to do.
Now, you say part of your role as a conductor is a teacher, even to professional musicians on a piece particular like this one.
And the word maestro means teacher. That's all it means.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah. But I'm thinking about when you were being taught about these particular works, I would imagine it was a far different experience because we've had such a sea change in classical music. Or did you have this rare conductor that was...
But I came up a different path. I was a chamber music player. And I rarely played in orchestras. And I've seen that style. I used to play in the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, and some of the conductors who came were tyrants. I mean, everybody was terrified of them. But I came up in chamber music, and chamber music is equality and sharing and all those wonderful qualities. And so that's a natural place for me to be. And I know all the stories about the dominating conductors who, the wonderful story of Toscanini, who shouted and fired a musician in the middle of the rehearsal because he stopped playing because he was so terrified. And Toscanini said, "You're fired!" And the man said, "You're a no good son of a bitch!" And Toscanini shouted back, "It's too late to apologize." <You know? laughs> Well, that's a different world, and it's passing. I mean, it's no longer. But in corporate America, you get a lot of that kind of dominating, and also in the political world. I mean, it's
intimidation.
It's intimidation, and there's no grace. There's no sense of participation, of engagement with people as human beings, and love. I mean, love is the source of effectiveness.
Now, while you're here doing the symphony, you're also talking about philosophy, the art of possibility, which you've been writing about and giving lectures to CEOs like that. One of the things I was really struck by is in your own teaching, you at the beginning of the class, you would tell every student, you're an A student.
Yeah.
And to write down what they expect to know at the end of the class, which I think that's a really...
Well, now I have to be very specific. Okay. This is a technology. It's a strategy. The students in a major conservatory in a major city like Boston are going to feel extremely competitive. They're very anxious about their careers. They're looking over their shoulders all the time at the other people and wondering whether they're better or whether they're good enough or whether they're not, and they made a mistake. And it's a terribly tense atmosphere in such a place. And I saw that in my class at the New England Conservatory, that the students were so dominated by this fear and this competitiveness that the music couldn't shine through, right? So what I started doing was I gave every student at the beginning of the class an A. That's the highest grade. There's no A plus, just an A for everybody, right? And then they had to write a letter at the beginning of the year in the first 2 weeks, which was dated the following May, when the class ended, right? So now they're standing in May, and the letter said, "Dear Mr. Zander, I got my A because..." Then they would describe who they had become by the following May to justify this extraordinary grade. And that's the person I would teach, the person who was described in that letter. And that changed the relationship completely. And that A we can give to anybody. You can give it to a waitress or to one's spouse or to one's boss, or you give an A to somebody. That transforms the relationship. And I'll talk about this at some length on Friday morning when I'm going to speak to the Tulsa Town Hall. Mm. And that's all sold out, apparently. Yeah. But the concert is not sold out. So what I want to tell your listeners, and incidentally, the concert is very original. We're doing something very original, which is I'm starting at 7:30 explaining the Mahler Second to the audience with the orchestra together. It's very exciting. This is a very rare thing. I've not heard of other people doing this. But we're going to, for about half an hour, I'm going to explain everything that I can in that amount of time about what the Mahler Second is about, with the story, the libretto, whatever you like, about this piece, and how teach people how to listen to it. And then we'll play the piece through. So it's going to be a very exciting evening.
All right. Well, we're looking forward to it and looking forward to hearing more about the art of possibility of it's almost like you're expecting the best out of that person.
Right.
And it's much like an orchestra conductor. You expect the best out of your musicians.
And did you feel that yesterday? Yeah. Absolutely. You feel it in the rehearsal. Well, I went to a maximum security prison, for instance, and spoke to 150 serious criminals. You don't get into a maximum security prison. The walls were 70 feet high with barbed wire at the top. You know, this is not for petty criminals. And I talked to them for 2 hours, and we had a most amazing time. And I gave them all an A, and they felt that. And at the end, we sang the Beethoven Ninth in German in that prison in Huntington, Pennsylvania. And it was just amazing, amazing experience. So you can give an A to anybody. Everybody has the different grades in their personality from A through to F. And in prison, of course, F is what dominates. But in those 2 hours, A was the only grade for everybody. And it had an amazing effect on people. People were moved and grateful and enlivened in a way because nobody ever treats them as an A. Never.
I love the fact that you asked them to write everything down of what they were going to accomplish, what they were going to learn. And it almost sets like they're creating the primer for what they're going to do.
Exactly. And they can't fail at it. It's not as if their grade is going to be demoted. But it's a possibility to live into. Do you see that? It's not like climbing up a mountain and hoping you get there. It's that's who you are. And then you live into that possibility. And if you make a mistake, I always say, tell people who make a mistake, you throw your hands in the air and say, how fascinating, because then you have an opportunity to learn from it. Go on to the next thing. So it's an atmosphere of trust and engagement and love and enthusiasm and joy.
Well, we're looking forward to the performance Saturday night at the Chapman Music Hall. Benjamin Zander, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
And with you. Thank you so much, Rich.
Conductor, musician, author, and public speaker Benjamin Zander speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the conductor of the Boston Philharmonic and Boston Philharmonic Youth Orchestras, and he'll be guest conducting the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra in their program Saturday evening at 7:30, featuring Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 2, the Resurrection Symphony. For details on the concert, visit tulsasymphony.org. He'll also be doing several speaking engagements involved with his book, The Art of Possibility, as well. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. We're going to leave you with music from the Mahler Symphony No. 2 from Zander's recording with the Philharmonia Orchestra. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.